stairs. Josie tried to free herself, but he was too strong.
He called you, didn't he? He left me a message and said that he would. What did he tell you?
He told me they had a backup of the security video and that I needed to see it.
Were you on the video?
No, Mendoza said. They reached the bottom of the stairs. They were in the basement. There was no one else there with them.
But you went there, didn't you? You saw the tape. Did you kill them because of it?
He stopped short and wheeled around to face her.
Admit it, Bruno.
His lip curled into a snarl. I didn't want to do this. But you haven't given me a choice.
You didn't want to do...
The sentence trailed off. His hand twitched in the direction of his holstered gun. Josie went for it, but he blocked her. He brought up his elbow and struck her in the face. She fell away from him. His hand slid into his jacket, and then they heard the siren. Mendoza was distracted for a moment, and Josie took her chance. She swung her elbow up into his face. The bony point caught him on the side of the temple. He was taller than she was, and it was difficult to put any power into the blow, but it caught him by surprise. He tripped and fell to the floor. Josie followed with a kick, driving the point of her boot between his open legs and into his crotch. Mendoza yelped in pain. Something fell out of his jacket pocket onto the floor. His cell phone. She scooped it up.
Josie!
She kicked him again, turned away, and ran back up the stairs. The noise grew louder. Milton edged to the open doorway and glanced out. The walkway swarmed with inmates. They were spilling out of the cells. He looked up. He could see through the metal slats of the walkway above him that the doors had been opened on that floor too. More men were coming out, their curiosity quickly changing into something more urgent and desperate. The prison was full of dangerous men. Under normal conditions, it exchanged the loss of liberty for order and security. It was a menacing place, but if you played by the rules, it was possible to serve out a sentence and leave in one piece. This was different. It was chaos now, and for as long as chaos suppressed order, the prison was almost unimaginably perilous. Without order, grudges could be settled. Vendettas followed, blood spilled. Milton didn't care for the quarrels of his fellow inmates, but he needed to get around them so that he could start to make his way out of the building. One of the unconscious guards was just outside the open door. He reached and grabbed the man's ankle, yanking him inside. He frisked him quickly. He had a bunch of keys attached to his belt, and Milton flipped through them until he found the one that would open his cuffs. He bent his right wrist back so that he could work the key into the lock, twisted it, and popped the mechanism. The cuffs sprang open, and Milton shook them off. One orange-shirted prisoner ran by the open door and tackled another to the ground. The first man pinned the second to the metal and pounded at his head and face, a flurry of lefts and rights that splashed blood and saliva and mucus over the metal surface. The man kept punching, even as his victim lay still, his fists rendering his face unrecognizable. He was about to leave the cell when he heard another boom from the shotgun. The inmate's body was suddenly riddled with shot. The pellets shredded his clothes and the flesh beneath. He fell forward, his blood commingling with his victim's. Milton risked a look up at the booth. The guard was reloading. He had to move. The inmates were spilling down the stairs to the communal area at the bottom of the building. Milton took the billy club with him and stepped out of the cell, following the flow along the walkway. The atmosphere was charged with a frantic energy, and exultant whoops bounced back from the walls. The breakout was gathering momentum. Soon, it would be difficult to stop. There was going to be a full-scale riot. Milton was borne down the stairs by the surging crowd. He reached the bottom and caught a glimpse into the first cell as he was jostled ahead. Two men were holding a third man down as a fourth watched. Another pair of inmates was scuffling, toppling back against the table tennis table and bumping the two sections apart. Milton heard a scream and looked up. The elevated booth had been breached, and the guard with the shotgun was struggling with the prisoners who had surged inside. The man was dragged out onto the platform and, as the men paused to watch, he was thrown over the balustrade. His body fell through the vaulted space and bounced horribly as it slammed into the concrete floor just yards from where Milton stood. Chapter 63. Josie ran back in the direction that Mendoza had brought her. The building was chaotic. Staff were running freely along the corridors, hurrying to the exit. She bumped flush into a guard. "What is it?" she asked him.
"The cells, the doors, they're open."
Ziggy, she thought. It worked. The man looked at her, panic in his eyes.
"The inmates, they're getting out. There's going to be a riot. You have to leave. We all have to leave."
"Which way is it? I'll take you."
The guard set off and Josie ran behind him. He took a left and then another left. The corridors all looked the same, and she hadn't been paying attention to where Mendoza had been taking her. She was quickly lost. They turned a corner, and she saw two orange-shirted inmates coming straight toward them. The guard crashed into both of them. The first inmate drew back his fist and stabbed it into the guard's chest. Josie saw a flash of something metallic as he withdrew his arm, and then the droplets of red blood on the bare concrete floor. The inmate spotted her, smiled, and stalked ahead. Josie was next to a door. She turned the handle. The door was unlocked. She pushed it open and darted inside. The room was dark. Josie glimpsed the shapes of a table, two chairs, and a sofa. It was some sort of waiting area. There were no windows. She shut the door and looked for a key. She couldn't see one. The handle rattled as it was turned, and the door opened an inch.
"Come on,"
a voice called out. She slammed it shut again and put her back to it.
"Come on, baby, open up."
There came an angry hammering at the door.
"It's just me and my little shank. Come on, open the door." "Shit."
The pounding stopped. Josie waited with her back to the door, hardly daring to move. She waited another 15 seconds and then, knowing that she had to do something, she went to the sofa, grabbed it with both hands and pulled. It was heavy, but she was able to muscle it across the room, the legs scoring marks across the wooden floor. She hauled it in front of the door and pushed it until it was flush with the wall. It was just in time. The handle turned again as someone tried to force the door open. The sofa jerked forward an inch or two until she pushed it back and held it in place. Now what? She was stuck here. She looked around the room. It was practically empty. She wished that she still had her pistol. That reminded her. She reached into her pocket and took out the cell phone that Mendoza had dropped. It was unlocked. She tapped in the number that she had just given Milton. The phone rang three times.
"Milton?"
"No, Hernandez."
"Where are you?"
It was Ziggy.
"I'm inside the building. The inmates are out. There's a riot. I can't leave. Hold the line."
There was a moment of silence, and then Hicks came on the line.
"Are you safe?"
he said.
"I've barricaded myself in a room."
"Where?"
"I don't know. Somewhere in the administrative building. The door's not locked, though. I don't know how long it'll stand up."
There was another crash as the men outside hurled themselves against the door again.
"Josie?"
"You need to hurry. I can't hold them out forever."
"I hear you. Stay on the line. Ziggy wants to speak to you."
There was another moment of silence as the phone changed hands.
"I need you to send me your location," Ziggy said. "Put the call on speaker and do as I say."
She did. Ziggy told her to launch the Messages app and then start a text conversation with him on the number she had memorized. She tapped on the details icon and then told the phone to send her current location.
"Got you," Ziggy said. "I know where you are. I'll call the police and tell them that you're trapped."
There was another heavy thud against the door.
"I don't have time for that," she said. "It's a riot. The police will wait for the army, but that won't be for hours. The inmates know I'm in here. They'll break the door down."
She couldn't hear a reply. She pressed the phone to her ear.
"Ziggy, stay where you are. I'm working on it. Please hurry."
Chapter 64. Milton frisked the body of the guard who had fallen to his death. He was unarmed, but in his back pocket, Milton found a small Nokia cell phone. He took it and dialed the number that Josie had given him. The call connected.
It's Milton.
He heard Hicks.
Where are you?
There's a full-scale riot. I need a way out.
You can come out the front. The guards in the watchtower have cleared out.
Anything else?
We've got a problem. Hernandez is trapped inside.
Milton gripped the phone a little tighter.
Where is she?
Josie sat down with her back to the sofa, planted the soles of her feet flat on the floor and braced her legs. There came another thump as whoever it was outside in the corridor tried to force the door. The sofa jerked a little bit farther into the room and the door opened a crack.
Open the door! The man cackled through the gap.
I'm a police officer, Josie shouted back. And I'm armed!
Sure you are, baby, the man said.
I'll shoot anyone who tries to get in here.
Yeah! I say you're bluffing!
Josie heard a gale of laughter and then a stream of salacious suggestions about what the men outside would do to her once they got through the door. She wished that she was armed. That might have given her a chance, but she wasn't. Her gun was still inside the security lodge. If the inmates were logical enough and thought about it, they would be able to loot the office and arm themselves. That the situation could get worse was obvious, but it was also an irrelevance as far as Josie was concerned. It was already bad enough. There was no way out. No windows, no other doors. She was trapped, a female police officer, lost inside the swirling chaos of rioting prisoners, many of whom had no hope of being released and no hope of ever being with a woman again. They had nothing to lose. The fact that they could take out their anger and frustration on a police officer at the same time would be just another bonus for them. There came another almighty thud as something was slammed against the door. It was weightier and harder than before, more solid than the shoulder charges that she had been able to fend off. A heavy object. There came a second crash, and then a third. Josie heard a splintering, and, as she looked up above the back of the sofa, she saw that the door was splitting down the middle. Mendoza shouldered through the door that led into the main lobby. He stopped, his feet slipping on the floor. There were two orange-shirted prisoners blocking the way ahead. Mendoza didn't pause. He reached into his jacket, yanked his Glock out of its holster, and shot both of them. The men went down, one of them dead before he hit the floor, and the other trying to staunch the sudden rush of blood from his abdomen. Mendoza gripped the pistol tightly and ran for the door. Josie was still in there for all he knew, but he didn't care about that. She was the reason he had come down here. Her interference and disobedience had put them both in danger. Maybe the riot would put an end to that once and for all. It would save him the job. Two more prisoners emerged from the security lobby. Mendoza turned and fired. Both rounds missed, but the prisoners got the message. They dived into cover. He had seven rounds in the magazine and another in the chamber. He had to get out. He backed away, the pistol aimed at where the men had hidden, and then he turned and ran. Josie pushed back until her thighs burned. She wasn't going to give up. She closed her eyes and thought of Angelo. She would hold out for as long as she could. There came another crash, and then another rending creak as the door panel continued to split down the middle. There was a fresh crackle of laughter, an exhortation to redouble efforts, and then the sound of something heavy falling to the floor. Josie sat up. She heard a scream interrupted by a yelp of pain, and then the unmistakable sound of something hard colliding with flesh and bone. There was another impact as something dropped to the floor. She heard a cry of angry indignation that was choked off before it could be finished, and then the slap of running feet that quickly faded out.
Josie?
She pushed harder, her muscles burning.
Who is it?
It's Milton.
She stayed where she was.
Open the door.
Josie found that she was trembling, her muscles quivering uncontrollably. Was it Milton? He had found her. She was too scared to allow herself to believe that she might have a way out. Maybe it was a trap. But how would anyone else know to pretend to be him? There was no logic to suggest that it was anyone other than Milton, but panic was obscuring her logic. Josie, Milton said through the crack in the door, they'll be back. We need to move. Please, open the door. She got up and heaved the sofa aside. The door had splintered down the middle and wouldn't have stood too much more punishment. She opened it. Milton was standing outside. He was holding a prison officer's billy club in his fist. Three orange-shirted inmates sprawled on the floor, unmoving. One of them was bleeding freely from a wound to his scalp, the blood pooling around his head. Milton's own orange shirt was flecked with red, and there was sweat on his face. There were fresh marks, too, and darkening patches that promised fresh bruises. Ready? Milton said. She nodded. Come on. He started to jog. Josie followed, matching his easy pace. He reached into his pocket for a cell phone and put it to his ear, speaking as he loped along. Is it still clear? Josie couldn't hear the reply. It's Hicks, he explained as he put the phone back into his pocket. They're out the front. They'll pick us up.
What about the police?
There's no one there yet.
They'll be coming. The army too.
That's why we've got to hurry.
Milton led the way to the main entrance hall. A fire had been set in one of the adjoining rooms and smoke was pouring out of broken windows and an open doorway. They saw other prisoners choking as they emerged into the dimness of the main room. The security lobby had been overrun, with inmates passing through the defunct scanner and making their way to the doors and the clean, open air beyond. They were fixated on the prospect of their freedom, and none of them stopped to give Josie any heed. The one man who did divert his direction to intercept them, making a lewd comment as he approached, was briskly persuaded to see the foolhardiness of his ways. Milton swung the baton at him in a diagonal downward swipe that caught him on the bony knuckle of his knee. He yelped in pain, rolling to the ground and clutching his leg. The main doors had been forced open, and now they swung impotently on broken hinges. Milton shouldered them apart and, reaching back to take Josie's hand, led the way outside. She looked up at the watchtowers and remembered seeing the rifles of the guards stationed there. But the guards were not there now. More smoke piled out of smashed windows and formed vast pillars that were already several hundred feet tall. She saw the hungry yellow and orange of flames through other windows and heard the sounds of screams, whoops, and breaking glass. Run, Milton said. Don't stop for anyone. Milton set off to the main gate. Some inmates were gathered just outside, as if unsure what to do now that they had their freedom. She saw flashes of orange as others, perhaps wise to the inevitable arrival of enforcements, hurried across the neighbouring fields and into the dense vegetation that fringed them. The gates had been forced too, and now they hung limply, creaking in the breeze. A car was approaching them at speed. It flashed its lights. There, Milton said, changing direction. The car raced up to them, skidding to a sudden stop. The rear door opened and Josie slid in, bumping up against Ziggy Penn. His laptops were still open. Hicks was in the front and he reached over to open the passenger door. Milton slid across the hood, opened the door all the way and dropped into the seat.
Go!
Hicks did not need to be asked twice. He stomped down on the gas and the wheels squealed as the rubber bit into the rough asphalt. The car jerked forward and then swung around as Hicks turned the wheel to full lock, the rear end fishtailing and smoke pouring out of the wheel arches. Hicks straightened up and, stamping down on the gas again, they raced away. Chapter 65. Milton reached over and clapped his hand on Hicks's shoulder.
Well done, he said. It wasn't me. It was all Josie and Ziggy.
Milton turned. Ziggy was looking at him with a self-satisfied smirk on his face.
Good to see you again, he said.
That was fun, Ziggy said.
impressed? You have never failed to impress me. Milton knew Ziggy well enough to know that he responded best when his ego was massaged. He could certainly be irritating, but the fact of it was that he was able to back up his hubris with ability. Ziggy had helped Milton hack the headquarters of the Mossad. What he had done today was just the latest in a long line of increasingly impressive demonstrations. He turned to Josie.
Are you okay?
I'm fine. Thanks for coming for me.
You could have... No, he interrupted. Thank you. I'd still be in there without your help.
I don't have anyone else to turn to.
I meant what I said.
Your help.
You need to help me first. Tell me everything. Josie had explained her suspicions to Milton before. It was useful to have her rehash them. Milton and Hicks listened intently as she went back over the details of Milton's arrest and how she had come to be so certain that he had been framed. She recounted the death of the bar owner and the role that her commanding officer had played in moving Milton from Manila down to New Bilibid so that he could fall completely under de Lacy's control. She reminded him of the threats that she had received and her conviction that the same man was responsible for them.
He was there today, she said. It's why I couldn't get out. He grabbed me.
Where is he now?
I kicked him between the legs and ran. I don't know what happened to him.
What's his name? Milton said.
Bruno Mendoza.
Ziggy?
I'm already on it.
Milton watched as Ziggy's fingers flashed across the keyboard. He had tethered his laptop to his phone and, now that they were north of the prison and he had a reliable signal, he was typing in a string of commands.
What are you doing?
Josie asked.
I'm going to find out where he lives.
How?
Hack the police database.
This might be easier,
she said, holding up the phone she had taken from Mendoza.
That's his,
she nodded.
Give,
he said. Josie handed it over. Ziggy plugged it into one of the laptops and started to examine it.
If he can find the address...
Found it, Ziggy interrupted. He has a place in Makati City.
Fine, she said. We know where he lives. What do we do now?
Pay him a visit, Milton said. She bit her lip. Milton could see she was reluctant. What's up?
Am I doing the right thing? I don't know.
Maybe I should go and see the chief inspector. I mean, I could tell him what I know.
You don't know how far the corruption goes up the chain, Hicks offered.
He's right, Milton said. You know you can't do that. It could be dangerous, it'll also be slow, and we need to move today. When he finds out what's happened and that I'm out, maybe he runs. He certainly makes it more difficult to get to him. You won't be safe if that happens.
And then? When we find him?
We ask him who else is involved.
You think he killed your friend?
I don't think so. I think I know who that was. But maybe Mendoza can help me find him.
And then?
Milton knew what she was asking. How would he make her safe? There are two ways we can play this. I don't want him dead. She interrupted. Then you'll need to get the evidence to build a case. It was clear to Milton that Josie could see the scale of her quandary now. It was obvious. She could find evidence and build a case, but she wouldn't be able to do it alone. She would need help from senior officers that she could trust, and, from the look on her face, Milton could see that she was already struggling to think of anyone of sufficient rank that she could confide in. Maybe she didn't know anyone well enough beyond Mendoza to be confident that they would not be involved and that they would take the side of a junior officer against her more senior colleague. Milton already knew that Josie was moral. She had worked to get him out despite the risk to herself, but now she would face a test of her convictions. Milton would be true to his word and would do whatever he could to make her safe. He didn't have the same qualms as she did, though. and his way would be safer than any alternative. Following the law would bring greater risk, but she would have to choose. Milton would do whatever she asked. He looked at her. She was biting her lip and gazing out of the window.
"Where are we headed?"
Hicks asked. Ziggy recited an address in McCarty City.
"It's an apartment," he said.
"Where?"
Hicks waited for the sat-nav to calculate the route.
"Not far,"
he said, once the green line had overlaid the map.
"We can be there in an hour."
Chapter 66. They parked the car in the underground lot beneath the apartment block.
"Both of us," Hicks said to Milton.
"It won't hurt."
"I'm coming,"
Josie said.
"You don't need to do that," Milton said.
Josie shook her head. She wasn't about to take a step back now. She felt as if she were in a maze, stumbling for an exit that she couldn't yet find, but she knew that she had to be involved.
"I'm coming. This is a police investigation. I am not backing off now."
Milton shrugged. "Fine by me."
"I'll stay," Ziggy said. "I'll see what else I can get off his phone."
Josie stepped out. Hicks and Milton followed, and they took the elevator to the ground floor. Josie went up to the desk. She took out her badge and held it up for the porter to see.
"How can I help you, officer?"
"I need the key to the penthouse."
"Can I ask why?"
"Police business."
"But Inspector Mendoza lives there,"
she finished for him. "I know."
"I don't understand. He just left."
"When?"
The man looked at his watch.
15 minutes ago."
"How was he?"
He looked like he was in a hurry. What is this, officer?"
"Give me the key, sir."
"Do you have a warrant?"
"You really want to go through all that?"
"Then I should call him. I can't just let you inside."
"Last chance. I'll arrest you if I have to, sir. What'll it be?"
The man blanched. He stood up, took a blank key card and programmed it in a machine on the desk. He handed it to Josie.
"Here,"
he said.
"Top floor. The lifts are over there."
They took the lift in silence. It ascended quickly, fast enough for it to add to the empty feeling in Josie's stomach. She closed her eyes and thought of her son. What was the point of doing her job if she allowed herself to ignore what Mendoza was doing? She wanted to bring Angelo up to know right from wrong, and she would be worse than a hypocrite if she allowed her fear to take control. The lift arrived at the 29th floor and the doors opened. Milton stepped out first. They were in a lobby. The floor was thickly carpeted, and the walls were decorated with tasteful pieces of art. It was gloomy, with dim lights set into sconces. There were two doors, one for the emergency stairs and the other for the penthouse.
"Just because he's not here doesn't mean the flat is empty,"
Milton said in a low voice.
"We need to be careful."
Josie nodded. She slid the key card into the reader. The lock buzzed and the door clicked open. Milton touched the door with his fingertips and gently pushed it all the way open. Josie automatically reached down for her pistol. Her fingers touched up against the empty holster. The pistol wasn't there. She had left it in the prison security lodge. Shit! She wished that she had it. The room inside was dark. She paused, allowing her eyes to adjust to the gloom. The door opened into the living room. It was open plan, with a dining area and, beyond that, a kitchen. There were curtained windows to her right, and she went over to open them. There was a balcony outside, and she could see the tops of the neighbouring buildings poking up into the bright midday sky. Milton and Hicks walked inside and turned to the left. Josie followed. Milton opened the door to the master bedroom. It was empty. She crossed the apartment to the kitchen. There were two other doors. One led to a bathroom and the other to the second bedroom. Both of those were empty too. She went into the bedroom. Clothes were strewn across the bed and the wardrobe stood open. She ran her finger along a rack of empty clothes hangers. She turned. Milton was in the doorway. He had taken off the orange T-shirt. His torso was lean and muscular, and his skin was decorated with a number of tattoos. She could see the 9 inscribed over his heart, and, as he angled his body to look down at the dresser, she saw a large tattoo of an angel's wings across his back.
"You want something to wear?"
He realized that he was half naked. "Sorry, I needed to change out of the prison gear." She took a shirt from the rail and tossed it over to him. Mendoza was around the same size, and when Milton put it on, it was a decent fit. He looked in the full-length mirror that was fixed to the back of the wardrobe door. "What do you think?" The shirt was garish, mainly black, but decorated with a series of yellow sparkles and splashes. Josie allowed herself a smile. "Suits you," she said. He took an empty bag from the bed and stuffed the prison clothes inside.
"You found anything?"
She stood aside and indicated the clothes that had been disturbed in the wardrobe.
"Look."
"The porter was right," Milton said. "He did leave in a hurry. It's the same in the other bedroom. But where did he go?" Milton had an envelope in his hand. He handed it to her. It was stamped with a logo that featured a stylized mountain peak with a smudge of red that she guessed was intended to denote the sun. The name beneath the logo read Mount Malarayat Golf and Country Club. The envelope was open. She reached inside, took out the letter and read it. It was from a woman with the title of residential manager and congratulated Mr. Mendoza on the purchase of his luxury villa.
"How far away is that?"
Mount Malarayat was near Lipa City.
2 hours to the south?
You think he's gone there?
Unless Ziggy has a better idea, I think that's our best shot.
Chapter 67. They dropped Ziggy off at the airport. They had no clear idea where Mendoza had gone, but a flight out of the country was an option that they could not discount. Ziggy agreed to watch the terminal and contact them if he saw anything. He would also be able to hook into the Wi-Fi network and provide backup as they needed it. Hicks drove them. Lipa City was in the Batangas region, 70 miles south of metropolitan Manila. They followed Route 3 as it ran down the shore of Laguna de Bay, through Cabayao and Calamba, and finally into Lipa. The drive took 2 hours, and it was 3 p.m. by the time they arrived at the address they had found in the apartment. The property was located inside a gated community. The way into the complex was blocked by a barrier that was raised and lowered by a guard who sheltered from the sun in a neat little hut. They could see the villas nearest to the gate from their position on the road. They were obviously luxurious, even from the outside. Each looked spacious and was constructed with a natural stone facade that reminded Milton of similar villas that he had seen in Japan. A notice fixed to the wall of the compound announced that further construction was underway and that the compound would soon be equipped with a clubhouse, sports complex, and retail outlets. Prices were noted to start at $1 million.
"Nice," Hicks said. "The police are better paid here than they are at home."
Josie snorted.
"Don't be crazy. They pay us next to nothing. I live with my mother. There's no way I could ever afford a place like this. He shouldn't be able to either."
"Our friend Mendoza is on the take," Milton said, "and he probably has been for years."
"How do you want to do it?" Hicks asked.
"I'm going to take a closer look," he said.
"I'm coming,"
Josie said. "No, stay here with Hicks. It'll be easier for me to go in alone."
"If he's there?"
"I'll call you. Keep your phone on, and call me if you see anything." Milton got out of the car. It was swelteringly hot. He had found a pair of dark glasses in the glove compartment, and he put them on, shielding his eyes from the glare as sunlight reflected from the windows and the pools of the apartments next to the road. The complex was secure, encircled by a 6-foot-tall stone wall. Milton walked the perimeter until he found a quiet spot that was not overlooked. He heaved himself up, wincing from the flash of pain caused by the sudden effort, and dropped down onto the other side. The compound had been planted with a fringe of bamboo and dwarf fruit trees just inside the wall, and Milton was able to find a spot where he could observe without fear of being seen. A gardener had clambered up a coconut tree and was leaning back in a harness, a bolo in his hand. He lopped down with the blade, removing coconuts from the tree before they might fall on those passing below. He chopped down the leaves too, and a mate collected both and stacked them in the back of a small motorized trolley. Milton moved around, staying within the cover afforded. Mendoza's villa was near the entrance to the development, although not visible from where the car was parked. Milton found a spot where he could observe it. He watched as maids pushed trolleys loaded with fresh laundry and bottles of water. Expensive sedans and SUVs rumbled by. There were delivery trucks. Milton concentrated on the property. There was no sign that it was occupied. He waited until there was no one else around, and then he left cover and crossed the lawn. He moved confidently, as if he belonged there. The property was delineated by a low fence that reached up to Milton's chest. He glanced over it into the garden. The pool was the centerpiece, with two recliners arranged at one end. Milton reached the villa. They had all been built around the same design, all of them featuring generous windows to let in as much light as possible. Most of the windows were obscured by closed blinds, but Milton was able to look in on two of the bedrooms. There was no sign that anyone was here or that anyone had been here for some time. There was no one in sight. He clambered over the fence and made his way to the door to the garage. It was wooden and not particularly thick. He would have preferred to pick the lock, but he didn't have anything that he could use. Instead, he looked back over the fence again and, satisfied that he was still unobserved and that no one was in easy earshot, he approached. There was an art to kicking in a door, and Milton had done it many times before. He aimed his heel at the point just below where the bolt would protrude into the strike plate and then the frame. He kept his balance by driving the heel of his standing foot into the ground at the same time and avoided the lock itself for fear of injury. The door was made of soft wood and was hollow. It started to give way. The deadlock bolt extended only an inch into the frame and gave almost no resistance. The first kick loosened the lock, but the second broke it apart. The door opened. Milton went inside. There was a car in the garage, and next to that, a pair of bicycles hung from a bracket that was fitted to the wall. He paused once he was beyond the door so that his eyes could adjust to the gloom. He made out a set of shelves beyond the bikes and, opposite him, a tall American-style refrigerator. There was a workbench to his left with a selection of tools laid out alongside it. Milton reached down and took a hammer. There was a door next to the fridge. He gripped the hammer and approached it, listening intently. He heard nothing. Milton reached out for the handle and turned it. The door was unlocked. He pushed, opening it all the way, and then stepped inside. He was inside the kitchen. The blind was pulled down, and the room was dark. The oven had an LED display that cast enough dim light for him to be able to see. There was a sink, dark countertops, a washing machine, and a dishwasher. There was another door in the opposite wall. Milton stepped deeper into the room. He opened the opposite door and went through into the living room. The blinds were drawn in here, too. The room was empty and lit by the luminous green glow of a digital clock that sat on a sideboard. Milton opened the doors to each bedroom and checked those, too. The beds were made. There were no signs that anyone had been inside the rooms recently. He took out his phone and called Hicks.
"It's empty," he reported. "What do you want to do?"
"Have you heard from Ziggy?"
"He just called. He hasn't seen anything."
"We stay here, then." "I'll wait here. Watch the rope for me."
"Copy that."
Milton ended the call, put the phone back into his pocket, and settled down to wait. Chapter 68. Hicks moved the car farther up the road so that it was well away from the sentry post and much less suspicious. He settled back in his seat, watching the gentle flow of traffic that passed alongside.
"What's your son's name?"
he asked Josie.
"Angelo."
"Is he with your partner?"
"With my mother."
"You're not married?"
"I was. Not anymore. He was killed."
I'm sorry."
She waved his apology away. "We were separated."
"How did he die?"
"One of the president's bounty hunters. You know about him? The president? What's happening here?"
"Just what I've read."
"The war on drugs," she intoned. "Duterte promised that the fish in Manila Bay would grow fat on the bodies of criminals. My husband's name was on a list. Someone killed him because of it."
"He was involved in drugs?"
She shrugged. "I don't know. Maybe, maybe not. His name was on the list. That's reason enough."
Hicks shifted a little uncomfortably. Josie must have sensed it.
"How about you?"
she said, filling the sudden silence. "You said you had two?"
"I do. Caleb and Lucas. They're with my wife."
"She doesn't mind you coming here."
"We owe Milton a big favour. She doesn't mind."
"What did Milton do?"
He found it easier to talk about it with her than he had with Ziggy.
"My wife had cancer. She needed treatment in the States, but we couldn't afford it. Milton found the money for us."
A car passed them and slowed for the turn into the compound.
"What do you think?"
he said to her.
"Mendoza has a Porsche," she said.
"That's not a Porsche."
"No."
She frowned. "You think he's coming?"
"Maybe. We haven't got anything else to go on."
"Where is he?" Milton searched the property. It was of a reasonable size, and he took his time working his way through it. For the most part, he found what he would expect to find. Summer clothes in the closet, utility bills filed neatly in a bureau in the space that was used as an office, neatly stacked laundry on a shelf above the washing machine. There was a laptop computer in the office, and Milton disconnected it and put it to one side, confident that if there was anything of interest stored on it, then Ziggy would be able to recover it. He moved into the master bedroom, and as he dropped down to his stomach to look under the bed, he found a black aluminium case. He pulled it out. It was locked, with two padlocks threaded through metal-reinforced grommets. Milton put the case on the bed, went back to the study, and collected two paper clips from a bowl that he had noticed earlier. He opened the clips and bent each of them into an L shape. He used one of the clips as his pick, and the other as his wrench, and as he applied slight pressure, he was able to pop the lock. He repeated the trick for the second padlock, slid them both out of the grommets and opened the case. Nestled inside a foam inset were two Taurus PT-111 Pro G2 handguns. The model was lightweight and had a thin profile, perfect for concealed carry. The guns were chambered in 9mm, and the case also contained two magazines with 12-round capacities. Milton took one of the pistols, pushed a magazine into the butt, and put it in his pocket. He would give the other one to Hicks. He had noticed something else under the bed. One of the floorboards extruded above the others, and when he investigated further, he saw that there were scraping marks around the bed's metal feet. He pushed the bed aside so that he could take a closer look. The floorboard was loose, and using the claw of the hammer, he was able to prise it open. There was a void beneath the floor, and, stuffed within it, Milton found a leather satchel. He took it out, unzipped it, and counted 10 thick bundles of banknotes. He riffled through one of the bundles and saw denominations for 200 and 500 pesos. It was difficult to guess with precision, but he suspected from the number of notes that there was perhaps 2 million pesos in the bag. $100,000. He put the banknotes back in the satchel and went through into the lounge. It was approaching 5 in the afternoon. Where was Mendoza? They had no other leads to go on. There would come a point where he would look at another way to find a route back to De Lacy, but until then, he figured that patience was the best policy. There was nothing to do but wait. They waited in the car for 5 hours. It was 9:10, and darkness had fallen when Hicks saw the glow of headlights at the end of the road.
You see it?
Josie asked him. He nodded.
That's a Porsche, she said.
Hicks watched as the car slowed and drew to a halt at the gate. It was a white Boxster with the roof down.
What do you think?
Hicks asked Josie. She squinted through the darkness.
I think it's him.
He took out his phone and dialed.
I'm here, Milton said, as soon as the call connected. There's a car at the gate. We think it might be him.
Copy that. Leave the line open. They watched as the guard came out of his hut and spoke with the driver. It was too gloomy to identify him, save that he was male. The guard concluded the conversation and went back to the hut. A moment later, the gate rolled back and the car drove into the compound. Hicks put the phone to his ear once again.
The car's coming inside.
How many people?
One, he reported. Male. It's too dark to ID him.
Copy that. Stay outside. If he comes back out again, follow him.
Affirmative, Hicks said.
The line was quiet.
What's he going to do?
Josie asked.
He'll get answers.
You've done this before, she said.
It was almost an accusation.
A few times, he replied, watching the bright red glare of the taillights as the car headed into the compound.
I want to do this properly, she said. Mendoza, I want him to be brought in.
He will be.
I'm serious. I'm going to arrest him.
Hicks didn't answer. Josie reached across and grabbed the phone from him.
This is Hernandez, she said. This gets done properly, Milton, you understand? I want to bring him in.
Hicks couldn't hear Milton's response.
That's how we do it, she continued. Otherwise, I'm going to go up to the gate now and tell them to let me in. Your choice.
Hicks looked at her. She was animated, her cheeks flushed and her eyes flashing with anger.
He wants to speak to you,
Josie said to Hicks, handing the phone back to him.
Hicks here.
Get ready to come through, Milton said. If it's Mendoza, I'll tell you. I'll need you both in here with me. Milton was in the living room. He heard the motor of the garage door as it slid up and back, and then the sound of a car's engine as it was driven inside. The engine was switched off, and the motor buzzed again as the garage door closed. He heard a car door opening and then slamming shut. Milton crossed the room to stand behind the door to the kitchen. A light was switched on in the kitchen. He saw the illumination beneath the door. He heard the sound of the microwave as it was programmed and then started. And, after a minute, he heard the ping as the program completed. He heard the hiss as a ring pull was opened. Milton held the gun in his hand, his back pressed up against the wall. He was calm. He knew what he had to do. The door opened, the light from the kitchen streaming into the room. A man came inside. Milton let him walk ahead and then stepped out from his hiding place. He raised his hand and, with a hard and firm downward strike, he crashed the butt of the pistol against the top of the man's head. Chapter 69. Bruno Mendoza felt as though his head was split down the middle. It was the pain that brought him around. It throbbed and pulsed, and, as he opened his eyes, he was rewarded with such a pounding that, for a moment, he felt as if he was going to be sick. He tried to bring his hands to his face, but found that he could not.
He glanced down. He was sitting on one of the wooden chairs from the dining room. A length of cord had been fastened around both wrists and looped beneath the seat of the chair. Another length of cord had been bound around his torso, securing him to the seat back. A man was sitting opposite him. He had positioned the standard lamp so that it made a silhouette of him, obscuring his face and shining into Mendoza's eyes. The glare made his headache worse. He blinked the brightness away. When he opened his eyes again, he saw that the man had a pistol pointed at his head. "Wake up, Bruno," he grunted woozily. "Speak English, please." He swooned.
"You...
your head's a bit sore, is it?"
"You... hit me."
"That's right.
Who are you?"
The man reached up for the lamp and twisted it so that the brightness fell down onto his own face. Mendoza recoiled. The man's face was bruised and disfigured, his skin a mess of purples and blacks and reds, but he recognized him. Smith.
"You're supposed to be..."
"Locked up." Mendoza struggled, trying to free his hands. "I was locked up, that's right. Because of you, wasn't it?" The man reached for the shade and angled it so that it shone directly into Mendoza's face again. He blinked.
"No,"
he gulped out.
"I didn't. It wasn't..."
He stopped. "Don't worry," Smith said. "I'd rather not have to hurt you. If you answer my questions, there's no reason why anything bad should happen." The threat was implicit and unmistakable.
"What do you want?"
"Let's get back to me being locked up. You were involved, weren't you?"
"I don't know."
Smith leaned forward and pressed the muzzle of the pistol against his forehead. "I think honesty is going to be your best policy here, don't you? Let's try again. What did you do?" Mendoza gulped for air.
"They told me to have you transferred to Believe It."
"And you did that?"
I didn't have a choice."
"What?" Smith said. "They threatened you?" He gestured around the room. "Look at all this. You're on the take. They paid you."
"They would have killed me if I'd said no. I didn't have a choice, I swear."
Smith brought the chair a few inches closer. The angle of the light changed, and now Mendoza could see his face more clearly. He could see his eyes. They were icy cold, glacially blue, and without any hint of compassion or empathy. "We're going to have a discussion," Smith said, "you and me. I'm going to ask you a few questions about what happened, and you're going to answer them. If you don't, I'll have to persuade you why it's better to cooperate. That won't be a pleasant experience for you."
"I'm a police officer,"
he managed to protest, "and I'm a fugitive on the run from a prison break. I've got nothing to lose. If you can't help me show that I didn't murder my friend, what use do I have for you?"
"What do you want to know?"
"Who have you been working with?"
"He's English."
"Are you sure?"
"He had an accent like yours."
"What did he look like?"
"Your height, black hair, well-dressed, like a peacock. He always wore a suit, even in this heat."
"Name?"
"I don't know."
"Is it Logan?"
"He never told me."
"How did he find you?"
"I was working for someone else."
"Fitzroy de Lacey?"
"Not for him. For his company. Tactical Aviation. They wanted me to find evidence that they could use to get him out."
"How long had that been going on?"
2 years. 3. I can't remember exactly."
"But they paid for all this." Mendoza nodded.
Go on.
They said I would be working with someone else on a new project.
When?
A week ago. They told me to go to the docks in Tondo, and this man met me there. He said there had been a murder that day. I said, which one? We have murders every day. He said it was in a cheap hotel. An Englishman had killed a girl. We had you in custody by then. I knew it had to be you.
And what did he want?
He said to make sure that the investigation was wrapped up quickly. We weren't to dig into it too far. I was okay with that. We're too busy, and I didn't think we'd find anything, even if we did. And then he said you were to be transferred to New Bilibid.
But suspects waiting their trials stay in Quezon City.
I told him that, but he said it was important that you were moved.
He say why?
No.
What else?
I met him again the next day. He said that one of my officers was causing trouble. He said she was stirring things up. That wasn't what we'd agreed, and he said that I wouldn't get paid unless she backed off. So I told her. I said the case was closed, you were guilty, she needed to move on. But she wouldn't let it drop. I found her at the bar where you and the girl went the night she was killed. She was trying to get the tape from the security camera.
And?
And I told the man.
And then the barman was killed. Did you know?
I saw the report.
Was it you?
No, he said. I didn't. You might not have pulled the trigger, but he'd still be alive if it wasn't for you, wouldn't he?
Mendoza swallowed.
Keep going, Smith said. He called again. He said that my officer had gone to visit you in Bilibid. He told me to deal with her, meaning...
He didn't answer.
I had to get her to stop.
What did you do?
I tried to frighten her.
Did you put something under her door?
A picture of her son.
And?
A bullet.
Mendoza swallowed and looked away.
Okay, Smith said. You're doing very well, Inspector.
A few more questions. This man. How do you get in contact with him?
I can't.
When you told him about the video at the bar, how did you reach him?
A phone number.
Can you remember it?
I have it written down.
Good, he said. You're going to call him for me and set up a meeting. He squirmed. The cord cut into the soft flesh of his wrists.
Please.
I don't... You're going to call him and set up a meeting, and then you're going to the police station. And you're going to sign a confession admitting to everything you just told me.
That's not...
Milton stopped him mid-sentence. Josie? Mendoza was suddenly aware that there was someone else in the room with him. He heard the sound of footsteps, and as he turned his head to the left, he saw Josie Hernandez. Did you get it? She was holding a smartphone. Josie? He said. Hold on. Josie played with the phone.
He came back the next day. He said that one of my officers was causing trouble. He said she was stirring things up.
Mendoza's eyes widened a little as he listened to his own voice.
Josie, you piece of shit!
She spat at him.
It's not what it...
Smith reached ahead and backhanded him. Pay attention, Inspector. The recording is one thing. The other thing, and you want to remember this very carefully, is this. I know where you live. Here, and your place in the city. And even if you run and you go somewhere else, I'll find you. You might think that the man you were dealing with is dangerous, but you don't know me. The reason you're still drawing breath is because Officer Hernandez wants to do